We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
From WILL Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, our technical director, Jason Croft. Our guest in this hour of Focus is a bioethicist. Her name is Vicky Kind. She joins us today to explore the thickets that confront us when we're called upon as caregivers to make decisions for others. It may be a loved one without the ability to make decisions or with limited capacity for making decisions, or someone without the ability to communicate with us. It is also a situation that healthcare professionals deal with in their work with patients. Vicky Kind is the author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. The book offers us tools and techniques to guide us to informed and respectful decisions. Listeners, I look forward to hearing from you this morning. I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Vicky Kind, is a clinical bioethicist, medical educator, and hospice volunteer with experience in homes and hospitals. Her book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, is available in paperback from Greenleaf Book Group Press. And you'll find her online at www.thecaregiverspath.com. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and our email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Vicky Kind, so good to talk with you. How are you?
I am wonderful today. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Here at the outset, I would like to share with our listeners the first paragraph from your book. This is the book I wish I had when I was 21 and my mom had a massive stroke. I was thrown into a world I knew nothing about, the world of medicine. I felt helpless and all alone, although I wasn't actually alone. I had three wonderful brothers, but we were all inexperienced when it came to caring for and making decisions for someone who had become disabled, both physically and mentally. I was worried not only about my mom's health, but also about making the right decisions for her. What a situation to find yourself in when you're 21 years old.
Yeah, I didn't see it coming, that's for sure. I'm 46 now, and so that's 25 years ago. And I think, you know, it would have been easier now because we have wonderful resources, we have the internet, we've really grown in the caregiving community, but back then there was nothing. And I think one of the things that was the hardest thing for me, not only the overwhelmingness of caregiving, but the doctor wasn't respecting my mom's wishes. Mm-hmm. My mom had actually told us what she would want if something ever happened to her, but the doctor wasn't interested in that. And so my mom lived the way the doctor thought she should, and not in the way that she would have wanted to live. And it was really frustrating.
Yeah. Has that changed?
It changed to a great degree because the field of bioethics has improved, healthcare and our laws have improved, but it still happens. Every day I get calls from people who say, my mom's advanced directive or living will says she doesn't want CPR, but the doctors just did CPR on her. What just happened? So unfortunately, the mistakes still happen.
Yeah. What advice do you have for people about talking about what they would want if decisions would have to be made by another?
Well, the first thing is that I think you should do it as a family. What usually happens is we go to our elder and we say, you know, you might die, and so let's talk about it. Nobody wants that conversation.
Ouch.
Yeah, ouch. I mean, that's why everyone's so resistant. I actually believe the whole family, everyone over 18, should sit together and have a conversation about their values, their beliefs, what's important to them, because it's not just about when you might be dying. It's any time that you're too sick to speak for yourself. So what I encourage families to do is to sit together, hopefully to have one of those forms, depending on your state, what it's called. In Indiana, is an advanced directive, and talk through what kind of life would I want if I became disabled. What would I want in that situation where I can't recognize my loved ones anymore? Maybe I cannot move the way I used to. What's important to me? And when you do it as a group, it takes the pressure off, and also the family then knows what each other wants. So when the crisis happens, it's not a question that's never been talked about. It's a question that you can say, I remember she said this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of comfort in that, because nobody wants to feel like, I don't know what to do, and the doctor's asking me, and there's all this pressure. It's a lot easier to say, it's still difficult, it's still a crisis, but I know the right answer.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, when you were 21, you did not see that stroke, on the horizon for your mom at all. It was so fast, and accidents happen to us all the time. And we don't see it coming, and so we're unprepared.
Yeah, a lot of caregivers actually don't even realize they've become a caregiver, because it sneaks up on us. You may have that dramatic event where it's an accident or a stroke or some kind of brain injury that just happens, but a lot of times it's just, I'll take mom to the doctor this week. I'll pick up mom's groceries. And all of a sudden, you're turning into a caregiver. And people don't realize how exhausting that can be. They don't realize that I'm a caregiver. No wonder I'm so tired. No wonder I'm so busy. And so then they don't reach out and get the support and help that's out there. Because if you don't know you're a caregiver, you don't know to ask for help.
Yeah. Going back to what we want should something happen to us, what happens if your wishes have not been made clear and maybe you have no family, or your family is unable or unwilling to be your advocate?
Unfortunately, this is happening more and more. We are finding that there are so many people being abandoned in nursing homes. They either don't have a family, or all their family is gone, or there's been a family rift and people don't speak together anymore. So we have all these people who have nobody. Now, the way it's supposed to work is that you're supposed to be assigned a guardian or a conservator, someone who can speak for you, and that comes from the court system. But in many states, including Indiana, there aren't enough conservators. There aren't enough people out there who can step in, because it's a number that's growing too rapidly. So that becomes a really big issue, because now the doctor's saying, who's going to sign the consent form? Who's going to authorize these treatments? And there's nobody. So what we're doing out in California, and it's starting to be done in other areas, we're actually creating what's called advocacy teams, where a group of people from the hospital, usually members of the bioethics committee, some community members, the chaplain, we sit together and we do the best we can to make decisions for people. Now, it's never respecting their wishes, because we don't know their wishes, but it is, we're really trying to watch out for that person.
Mm-hmm.
Good decisions that will, reduce their suffering and improve their quality of life. But this is why I tell people, you really need to talk to your family or your friends or at least your doctor about what kinds of things you would want done to you, because you don't want a bunch of strangers talking about you. You don't want to have other people making your life and death decisions.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned an ethics panel as being part of a hospital setting. What about a nursing home or an assisted living facility?
Well, some of them have them, but in my experience, they're not very active and they're not really well trained, and they really don't function very well. Every hospital has an ethics committee. So if you're ever in the hospital and things aren't going right, you can pick up the phone, the hospital phone, dial O for the operator, and the operator will connect you to somebody from the bioethics committee, or ethics committee, they're called both. that person will come in, they'll help you work with the doctors, they'll figure out what's the right thing to do, and they're a wonderful resource completely free that we can all use. But it doesn't really work that way in nursing homes. The best thing you can do in a nursing home is to contact the ombudsman. It's not a word we use often, but the ombudsman is like a patient advocate. And every nursing home has to post a poster that says ombudsman and the phone number in big print. So you just call them, and you can do it anonymously because you don't want things to get, you know, it's hard to report something that's going wrong when your loved one is still living there.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll come in, they'll work with you, they'll give you some guidance, and then if it's something that's very terrible that's going on, they'll report it to elder abuse or other services like that. So in the hospital, we use ethics committee, but in the nursing homes, you're probably going to use the ombudsman.
Yeah. Here in Illinois, we have an agency on aging, and there are regions of the state. Each region has an ombudsman. And when my mother was very ill, this individual was a tremendous help. So I want to mention that to people listening this morning, because if you're in this situation, you kind of wonder, and I'm sure Vicki and I will talk about this, you know, where do you start? What should I be doing? What questions should I be asking? What are my mother's rights? The Agency on Aging is terrific. My experience with the ombudswoman, actually, was really, really important. It made life, oh my gosh, she was heaven sent. So
yeah, I'm a huge fan of our area agencies on aging. In every state, in every community, there are these local groups that are highly trained professionals who will guide families through all of these different caregiving issues, whether it's nursing home issues, finances, you know, dealing with your veterans' benefits, dealing with your insurance billing. I mean, they cover everything, and it's all free services. You just look up Area Agency on Aging in your community. They all have a slightly different first part of their name because it depends on the locality, but it really is a wonderful service. And that's what I really want people to know, is that you don't have to be alone on this journey. You know, I felt really alone. It was terrible, and I don't even know what resources were available because I never found any.
Mm.
But now we've got them, you know. And the other thing you can reach out for is support for your loved one's particular illness. We have organizations like the Parkinson Foundation and the Alzheimer's Association, the Stroke Association. I mean, almost every disease has support groups, information, everything you need. So please, please get some help because it's too much.
Yeah. Vicki Kind is our guest this morning here in this hour of Focus. She is a bioethicist, and she's with us today to explore the thickets that confront us when we're called upon as caregivers to make decisions for others. Vicki Kind is the author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You may also join us by email. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call now this morning from a listener in Urbana. Hi, line one.
Hi, I would like the yes opinion on a form called Five Wishes, and I guess I would like her to comment on how good she thinks her form is or how bad, and its legality, whether it would stand up. And I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay.
Hi. Oh, thank you. That's a great question. I actually am a big fan of the Five Wishes form. It's another form like what's called an advance directive or a living will. And what I really like about the Five Wishes form is that it works in ways that the advance directive form doesn't. It's very personal. It asks you questions about how you would want your pain managed, what would comfort you when you're ill. It's not just about medical decisions. It's about how you want to be treated and cared for through the journey of your illness and the journey toward your death. It's a wonderful form because it's a soft human form. It's very, it expresses the things that really matter. Now, in every state, it's different whether it's legal. And I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me if it's legal in Illinois. But if you go to Five Wishes, they will give you that information. It's legal in about 40 states right now. It comes in lots of different languages, including Braille, which is wonderful. If it's not legal in your state, what you can do is you can add it to your advance directive as an addendum. You're allowed to personalize the state's form that you have to use and then add more information to it. So if your Five Wishes is not something you can use in your state, you can still give it to the doctors and say, this includes extra information about my beliefs and what would be important to me if I'm very ill. So I'm a huge fan of the form. I think it really opens up different kinds of conversations.
Mm. And we have an email question for you now from a listener in Urbana. And the question is, do you foresee the hospital ethics committees being called by some, quote, death panels?
Oh, yeah. You know, that was terrible political. Oh, my gosh. It set things back so far. We are never death panels. I mean, and it's really frustrating because the core of bioethics is to honor and respect people's wishes. The people who are drawn to the field of bioethics are incredibly compassionate and honor. They have so much honor and dignity. And so for people to say that about us was just really dreadful because we're your safety net. If things aren't going right, we're the people that really actually help make things better. So if you do have a bad doctor who's making bad decisions for you, we're the ones that are going to step in there and protect you. So if you are in a situation where life and death decisions have to be made, what happens is we find out, what would grandmother say about this situation? What would grandma want to do? We're never in a power position to tell people what to do. We ask lots of questions. We say, what about her religion? What about her culture? What about her personal values? Because that's what's supposed to be guiding our decisions. It's actually something we call substituted judgment. When the family member or the loved one is in that position of making the decisions, they're supposed to think about what grandmother would want and then honor what she would say. Now, sometimes that's tough because you may not agree with what grandmother would want. You know, sometimes families come to me and they say, I know my grandmother says she's done and it's okay and she's ready to go to heaven, but I don't want her to go. You know, but that's what we have to clarify, that it's not our bodies, it's your grandmother's body. We really are supposed to be doing right by that person. So the idea of the death panel is just so foreign to us because that's not what it's about. It's really about honoring and respecting the person and doing right by them.
And after reading your book, as I understand it, an ethics committee is, in the absence of knowing a patient's wishes, absolutely compelled to or held to what is called the best interest standard. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Now, could you ask me earlier, what happens when we don't know what somebody would want? There is nobody to speak for them. So if we can't use the thing called substituted judgment where we speak for our loved one, if we don't know what that person would want because they never told us, or maybe they've been terribly disabled since they were a child, so they were never able to express their wishes, or maybe it's a distant relative you don't know and now you're in charge, the tool that we use from bioethics is called the best interest standard. This is what we have to use when we want to think about what's in the best interest of this person. And as in bioethics and in healthcare, what we do is we work with the people who are going to be making the decisions, whether it's the distant family or the conservator or guardian, and we say, let's look at all the pictures, all the big issues here. Here are the medical options. Here are how those options are going to affect this person's body. If we do this, they're going to have a lot of suffering, but they might get better. Or if we do this, there's very little chance. But when they're finished with this treatment, I mean, we go through all the issues, not just the medical issues, but the quality of life issues. What are we actually doing to this person? How will this person's body and life experience our decisions? That is a really huge responsibility, and it's something that in medicine we take very seriously. We use this best interest standard a lot with pediatric patients because children, when they're very small, they don't have much of a voice because they're little kids. And so we're doing things to children, but we have to be very careful about doing it in a way that is good for them and doesn't cause increased suffering or damage. So the best interest standard is a wonderful tool that we use in bioethics, and one of the reasons I write about it in the book is that a lot of families are in this situation. They don't know what their mom or dad would want, and I give them actual questions they can ask themselves, questions to ask the doctor, things to consider, so you really can get a good decision. Because the worst thing I find is that people will come to me 5 years after they've made a decision, and they're still full of guilt and grief. They're like, I don't know if I did the right thing. I feel so burdened by this. And that's not okay. We need to feel better about the choices we're making so we don't have to live with those kinds of regrets. I know I still have regret about some of the things that were done to my mom and some of the decisions I made. I didn't know better. You know, but now that I know better, you know, with my other relatives I've taken care of, I got it right. And that's what I want to help other families with, to have that peace of mind in those situations.
Yeah. I think here, too, it would be useful if you would talk about what's called the platinum rule. And this is a concept developed by Dr. Tony Alessandro. Is that correct?
Yes. Oh, thank you. I love this. Platinum rule. It really helps me. It helps me.
It's really something to think about.
Yeah, so I think all of us know the golden rule. It's found in almost every religion in the world. The golden rule says, do unto others as we would want to be done unto. And it's a wonderful rule because it reminds us to be kind and gentle with people and to treat people well. But one of the problems with the golden rule is that it always assumes that we know what other people would want, that if I would want it, therefore you would want it. And one example I use is the idea of giving hugs. Now, I'm a hospice volunteer, so I work with a lot of sad people. And what I like when I'm sad is to have somebody give me a big hug. Well, if I use the golden rule, therefore I must hug everybody else. But I know some of the listeners are probably saying, oh, dear, please, I don't want to be hugged, you know? Oh, don't let her come near me, you know, because not everybody wants that kind of comfort. Other people just want to talk or have some alone time. So the platinum rule says, do unto others as they would like to be done unto, as they would like to receive that support. So it reminds me to ask the question, how can I show you respect? How can I show you love? How can I comfort you? I let that person define what they need, and then I try to give it to them, you know, if it's possible, if it's appropriate. And it's such a better way of looking at it because it's still honoring that other person and doing right by them, but by the way they'd like to get it. So I really like the platinum rule. It reminds me to ask instead of assume.
And the other is front and center, and you take a back seat.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we take our, most of us are pretty self-centered. I mean, we live our life, we do what we want, you know, we make our own decisions. But this is really important when you're taking care of somebody else, especially when someone becomes voiceless and they can no longer speak for themselves. I think it's a very important responsibility that we have to consider the other person because they can't protect themselves. They can't protect themselves from bad caregivers who might be in a care facility, from a healthcare professional that doesn't understand their needs. We've got to be good advocates.
This is Focus. Our guest this morning is Vicki Kind, author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call this morning or or by email. Excuse me. The phone numbers, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I have another email question for us this morning. Who do the courts choose to be a conservator when there are no blood relatives available? How can I offer myself up as one?
You can get trained. The courts, there are programs where they will train you to be a court-appointed conservator. It's actually a profession you can do. You can do it privately and be a private conservator where you get paid from the person's estate and, or the family pays you to take over those kinds of decisions. But it's always done through a court. You cannot be a conservator without the court approving it. And there are guardian and conservator offices within every government, and they would love to have more people who are interested in being the decision maker. Now, the conservator has to make decisions both about the medical condition and the body. They call it the body conservator, but they also have to be able to manage the person's finances and other life decisions. So really, you become in charge of this person's well-being. So you have to watch out for their money. You have to watch out for their life and the life care plan you're building for the person and if health decisions come up. So it's a wonderful profession. We definitely need more people to go into this, but you have to be super responsible, very honorable, and really have good intentions because that person is at your mercy. You now are in charge of someone else's life, but it's a wonderful profession. I would encourage people to consider going into it. It's not an expensive profession to get into. There are reasonable courses out there. And I would contact your local courthouse and ask to speak to somebody in the conservator or guardian's office. Great. Oh, that would be wonderful. You should do it.
Okay. What kind of oversight is there for conservators?
Oh, very strict. They have to live up to very high standards legally. They have a lot of reporting that has to be done, whether you're a private or a public conservator. Everything you do gets evaluated by a judge. So there are judges that's what they manage. They manage the conservator groups. And so when you make certain decisions, especially the more risky decisions, whether it's health or finances, it has to be checked by the court. So there are strong regulations. The thing that I always encourage conservators to do, so for people who are thinking about going into this field, is you have to go and actually see the person you're taking care of. This is one of the things that frustrates me the most in healthcare is when the conservator is making medical decisions for someone, but they never come to the hospital and see what has happened to this person's body. I mean, sometimes people have tragedies and things are very different. You know, so if you're going to be taking care of somebody, I really think you need to invest that time, drive over to the hospital, spend a little time and see what's happened because the person may have changed dramatically since the last time you saw them.
And I want to thank the listener for writing in this morning. Also, he unfortunately did not have a very good experience with the Department on Aging, although I think there's a difference between the Department on Aging and area agencies on aging, so maybe we should keep that in mind as well. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to go back to the Platinum Rule because I think this also helps us understand that someone who has the capacity to make decisions has the right to make what we might consider a bad decision. And maybe you could talk about that, and then maybe we can talk about capacity and how it's determined.
Got it. So the other standard we use in medicine, we have three standards we fall back on. We've already talked about substituted judgment and best interest. The first choice that we use is something called autonomy. It's not a word we use a lot, but autonomy means that you have the right to make your own decisions. And this is something that's very valuable in the United States of America. People get to raise their children as they see fit. People get to make their own life decisions. We're very individualistic. And so with this idea of autonomy, if the doctor says to you, do you want surgery, you get to say yes or no. Now, even though the doctor really, really wants you to choose to do the surgery, you're allowed to make a bad decision and say, no, I don't want to. And then the doctor will say to you, but you might die if you don't have this surgery. You're still allowed to say, still, I don't want to. I don't want to go through that experience. I would rather take my chances. So the thing I tell people, because it's so hard, people want their friends, I mean, we want all of our friends and our families to do what we think is best, but that's not how it works. If you have the ability to think for yourself and you have what's called full capacity, you get to be in charge of your life, and people are allowed to make terrible, terrible decisions for themselves. It's frustrating, but it's something that we have to honor because we want the right to make our own decisions. And I know there's decisions that I've made where family has looked at me like, what are you doing? But they're my decision. And that sometimes gets frustrating when families will actually try to bully their loved ones into certain choices. And I really don't like it when doctors try to push people into decisions that aren't right for them. You know, the doctor's body is not going to experience the choice. The person's going to have to go through that chemotherapy. The person's going to have to live with the financial costs of their choices and all the other things that come with it. So that's autonomy. It says we get to respect other people's bad choices. We don't have to like it, but we do have to accept it. So it's a tough one.
Yeah. And if we're caring for someone with limited capacity, how do we determine how much say that person should have?
Yeah, well, what the doctors do, I'll tell you what the doctors do, and then I'll kind of talk about what we can do when we're in our home and dealing with that person on a daily basis. What the doctor does is they ask themselves when they're talking to your loved one, they never tell you they're doing this, they're just doing it in their own head, does the person understand there's a decision to be made? You know, so if they're talking to someone and they're acting a little confused or they don't seem to be able to follow the conversation, then they start asking questions like in their head, does this person understand that they're sick? Are they able to remember the information I'm giving about their disease, or are they losing track of it? And then they look at when the person is going to make that decision, were they able to evaluate all the different choices and think about how their values and beliefs would play out on that decision? So the person has to be able to do what's called rational thinking, where they can hold enough information that they can consider the information, apply their values and wishes, and then come out with a good answer. So there's a famous case in bioethics that's a good example of this. There was a woman who had terrible diabetes, and at that point she was going to need to have part of her leg amputated because of her disease process. And the doctor said to her, we need to amputate your leg or you'll die. And she's like, I don't want to die, but I don't want you to amputate my leg. So the doctors tried it again. They're like, okay, no, you have to understand, you can't have both. If you don't amputate your leg, you'll die. If we do amputate your leg, you'll most likely live. And then she would say, don't amputate my leg, but I want to live. And this actually went to a judge. It went to the court, and they looked at this person. They said, does she have capacity, or in legal terms, does she have competency? And the court, the judge, this is an old case. The judge actually came to the hospital, which is unheard of, but he came to the hospital because he wanted to see how her thinking process worked. And he decided that she was not capable because she couldn't understand that either decision she made, the opposite one, she couldn't have both parts of it. She couldn't live and keep her leg. And so that told them that she did not have capacity. So that's the formal way that doctors think through this when they're choosing whether or not you can be your own decision maker. And it's a similar thing that the courts go through. They look to see if you can think through that decision and that the decision makes sense. Not that the decision is a good decision, but that it makes sense for you because you're allowed to make that choice.
Mm.
Okay, so, but in our day-to-day work with our families, okay, so we have a loved one maybe living at home with us and we can tell that this person's getting more confused. One of the tests I use when you know that it's gotten really bad is, can this person stay home by themselves? Are they safe to stay alone? And I find that so many people will say to me, no, she's not really safe, but she still lives alone. Like, no, you've got to step in because she's at a danger to herself. She might forget she's cooking and light the kitchen on fire. She might fall. We do have to step in as the family member and start to protect that person when they're no longer safe by themselves or they're no longer safe to make their own decisions. So what I really recommend is that when you're starting to see early evidence, they're forgetting to take their medicine. Like my dad, he started asking me to write his checks. Now, it didn't cross my mind that it was early vascular dementia. I just thought he just wanted some help. But if I'd looked at it carefully, if I'd paid attention, I would have realized, he's an accountant. Why is he having me write his checks? But it was getting too hard. So when we're starting to have to do things or we're noticing they're forgetting little things, I really encourage people to take that person to the doctor and possibly to a specialist. If it's a senior, they should go to a geriatric physician, called a geriatrician, or your referring doctor, your primary care doctor, will refer you to a neurologist or perhaps a psychiatrist, depending on what they think is going on, and get a good evaluation. Because oftentimes it's something that's going on physically that can be fixed and the person's brain will recover. You know, so you want to get that medical checkup. Like my aunt, she was really sharp. She was really able to think for herself. She was just a doll. She was wonderful. But all of a sudden, if she got a urinary tract infection, she started to look like she had dementia. She got really confused and started acting differently. So I would take her to the doctor. They'd give her some antibiotics, and then my aunt would pop back and be her wonderful self. So you got to go get an evaluation because you cannot do this alone. If you're working with someone who's younger than a senior, you can still go to that primary care doctor, and then they'll make those right referrals to specialists.
Yeah. In these situations where things kind of sneak up on you, what might you do in a situation like this? Your loved one is trying to keep a problem under wraps.
Yeah. Well, you know, you cannot see something until you see it.
Mm.
So the first thing I would say to people who have some regrets about, I didn't see it coming, I didn't know, I didn't notice, you know, you're doing the best you can. You can't know something until it becomes obvious. But what I would do is I would start writing down the little things that you're suspicious of. Just start writing a log and then take that log to the doctor because they like seeing evidence of what's going on. And they might be able to help you put it together. You know, I'm noticing that she keeps putting the cup of juice, instead of putting the cup in the dishwasher, she's putting it back in the refrigerator. But there's nothing in it. Oh, okay, what does that mean? You know, so write down all the little things you're seeing. But a lot of people are great at hiding their dementia.
Yeah.
My dad was so charming and so verbal and lovely that his doctors, I don't think they ever really realized he was having dementia. But all of his stories didn't really make sense. You know, he'd tell these great stories, but they weren't true. You know, so you have to really partner with that doctor and say, this is what I'm seeing. This is why I'm worried. Because they only spend, 15 minutes with your loved one? They probably won't be catching it. Another thing is when people start losing things. I mean, we all lose our car keys, but when they start losing things a lot. Like, I found that my dad had lost his car keys, 14 times. He'd actually had to go out and get car keys made 14 times, and they were all over the house, but he couldn't remember where he'd put them, so he would get more keys made. You know, so pay attention. Look for those little things, and just keep a log until you see enough is going on.
Speaking of car keys, when is it time to take the car keys away?
The minute you think it is.
Hmm.
The minute you start questioning it, I think I might, my dad, I don't know that he should be driving, because that's one of those ones that by the time you see it, it's already time. I really encourage people to take away the car keys right, look at it, take a moment, of course, and think about it, think through it, but you need to take action. These are one of those moments that when it's too dangerous, that's when caregivers really have to step in when there's danger. Not only is he a danger to other people, but he's a danger to himself. So you have to step in. Now, there's some different ways you can do that. You can talk to the doctor and see if the doctor will report them to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Some doctors aren't willing to do that, but maybe yours will. You can write an anonymous letter to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and then they will, you know, take some action and have them come in and do a test and see if they can drive. You can also have your loved one have what's called a geriatric driving test, where you can go to a private company where they'll actually see if that person can really manage the driving. But I really think that most of us see it, and then we should take action, because unfortunately, a lot of times families who knew they should have done it, they don't do it until the car accident. And that's a terrible time to have to realize, I should have done it.
Yeah.
One of the things I remind people about, because it's not just about these decisions and these moments, it's about what kind of experience you're building for this person that you're taking care of. So when somebody loses their driving privileges, you need to figure out how they're going to get around. Would people from their faith community drive them to their religious services that week? Would people from their men's group pick them up so they can still go out and see people? Is there like a dial-a-ride or something else in your community? You also have to understand that you've just taken away someone's independence and their life control. And so they're allowed to be angry with you. They're allowed to be disappointed and upset. And they're allowed to be upset as long as it takes. Because it's terrible to lose your privileges, but just because it's terrible doesn't mean we still shouldn't take that action.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to be very understanding and allow that person to be mad at us for a long time. But we need to protect people.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes remaining in this portion of Focus this morning. Our guest today, bioethicist Vicki Kind, author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address will.talk@illinois.edu. One of the chapters in your book, Vicki, deals with our hearts. The title, When Our Hearts Get in the Way. And one of the things you talk about here is what you call care grieving. What is it?
Well, it's a word I created because there's so much grief and loss and sadness that comes along with caregiving, that I realized if you don't have a word for something, you can't express it. People don't take it seriously until you have an actual word for it. So it's a word I created called care grieving. Just for an example, before I talk about that, but years ago we didn't have a word called date rape. And if you don't have a word for something, you cannot fix it. Now that we have a word for that, we educate our daughters, we protect them, we can have a conversation about that and make it better. So that's why I created this word, is because care grieving is the grief that you feel when you care for and care about another person. I know that the kinds of losses that I experienced are experienced by all other caregivers. My time was no longer my own. I was so busy taking care of my mom, my life changed dramatically. I missed so many things, you know, that another 21-year-old would be doing. I was running the family business. I was now financially in charge of her. My money was going. I was completely overwhelmed and exhausted. I was sad because this wasn't my mom anymore. I didn't have that nurturing. There are so many losses and so much grief, and that's what really exhausts the caregiver, is that their life is now completely changed. And I think we have to acknowledge that caregivers are suffering. And once we acknowledge it and say it's okay to admit that you're suffering, it's okay to say this is hard, this, I never meant to do all this work. I'm going to do it because it's my mom, but oh my gosh, what just happened to my life? When you can verbalize that, you can actually go out and get support. You can go to caregiver support groups. There are online forums and chat rooms with caregivers that you can go and say, this is really tough. One that I really like is the Well Spouse Association forum. This is for people who are dealing with chronic illness or a dying spouse, and it's a place where you can go 24 hours a day and go in there and say your truth. I miss my loved one. They have dementia. They have Alzheimer's. They're no longer the person they used to be. They're here, but they're already gone. These things have to be spoken. These things have to have a safe place to be said. And so that's why I created the word, is we need to acknowledge it so people can then say, I need help.
Mm. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us on the telephone. We're going to take a call next from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I just have a quick suggestion about people who are faced with taking away the car keys. My mother-in-law was in this situation where somebody needed to take away the car keys, and since her daughter was the primary caregiver, she enlisted her brother to take away the car keys, and then he was kind of removed from the anger a little bit, and that made it a lot easier in that situation for my sister-in-law to get along and not be the bad guy.
Well, that's a great idea. Have somebody else take the hit. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
That is. Thank you. I will add that to my list of good ideas.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. And next we take a call from a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I've never been faced with the situation of the caregiver, but actually when I was just out of high school, I had to give up my driving privileges because of a neurological condition. And I can remember, I'll never forget the words my doctor used, which kept me from ever being tempted, really helped me a lot to deal with it. He said, you know, a lot of people in your condition are tempted to lie and attempt to get a driver's license and drive anyway. But he said, just realize someday you might wake up, regain consciousness, and realize there's somebody's little kid under the wheels of your car, and realize that you are responsible for causing this. And that really made a huge impression on me. And I was, even though other people, I've heard stories about other people who, you know, lied to their doctors and found ways to, as you say, hide their condition and get driver's licenses and drive anyway. I was never tempted.
Yeah, well, I'm glad the doctor said that, because it gave you the courage to still do the right thing. Thank you for being an honorable person. I really admire you.
Thanks for the call this morning. So how do you know when you're in the thick of it? How do you know you're getting it right?
You know, I think that a lot of people actually do have a gut reaction. They really do know that. Even though it's hard, it's never easy, it's still the right thing to do. The other day, a lady spoke with me after hearing one of my lectures, because I do a lot of speaking engagements, and she said, Vicki, I now know that I need to go home today, call the doctor, and have my mom get hospice. She needs that support. It's time for her to have all of that care and attention. That's what she needs. And she said, but what you really gave me was the sense of knowing I am making the right decision, therefore I have the courage to make the right decision. One of the things that I realize is I don't have all the answers, because I don't tell people what to do in the book. I tell them how to think it through, because we're all different. Our loved ones are different. So I give you lists of questions you can ask, different strategies and tools you can think through, and work on coming to the right decision. If you've asked a lot of questions of yourself and of the other people that are making the decision with you or will be helping your loved one, and you feel like you got enough information and you have some peace thinking, I don't want to put my mom in the nursing home, but this is a good nursing home. It's one we can afford. She needs this help. I need to protect her. I can be okay making this decision, even though it's a hard one to make. So I think if you become a little more educated and really try a little harder in the decision-making process, you will find some peace of mind.
Mm. And my apologies this morning to a listener who has phoned in from Rensselaer, Indiana. We don't have time to take your phone call this morning, but thanks for calling in. And I want to thank our guest this morning, Vicki Kind. Maybe you'll come back and be a guest at some point in the future, and we can go over some other issues we didn't get to this morning.
I would love that. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Vicki Kind is the author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. The book is available in paperback from Greenleaf Book Group Press. You'll find our guest online at www.thecaregiverspath.com.